I also consult for the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics in Geneva, and I'm the co-chair of the TB Evidence Subgroup of the Stop TB New Diagnostics Working Group. I'm pleased to introduce the co-coordinator of the symposium, John Rederhoff, who is the Associate Director for Laboratory Sciences at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And John also is the chair of the Global Laboratory Initiative, which is the morphed version of the Stop TB Partnership Subgroup on Lab Capacity Strengthening. John has done a lot of work on external quality assurance of microscopy and cultures. We have two co-chairs, Nulda Byers, who is the director of the co-director of the Desmond Tutu TB Center at Stellenbosch University and the editor-in-chief, co-editor-in-chief of the International Journal of TB and Lung Disease, and Jeremy Chakaya from Kenya, who is the director of the National TB program in Kenya. And I will now ask John to introduce the symposium and then hand over to the co-chairs.
Thank you. This actually does follow the theme. I hope you know you will remember we've said that a number of times, and that's our intent of the Global Laboratory Initiative. But this really is, this symposium is a good example of that, because some of this initiative is to look at issues of integration with the program, but also coordination integration between TB, HIV, and many other issues. The genesis of this symposium was that actually there was very similar symposiums proposed last year by the TB section and the bacteriology section. And so they asked, and this was an example, we got together and we worked out the focus on both diagnostics but also integration of the testing. And that's what we're also hearing, I think, from the speakers more and more. Diagnostics and the laboratory capacity plus program integration all need to go together. So with that, I'd like to just turn it over to Nolda and Chakaya, our chairs, to start our symposium. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be a bit cruel and try to keep people to their time because our last speaker, Rick O'Brien, has another meeting at 4. So, pardon? Okay, at 4:15. Okay. So without wasting any more time, it is then my pleasure to introduce our first two speakers. They've decided to split their talk, and the talk will be done by Keir Tandida from South Africa and Madhukar Pai. And it looks like Madhukar is going to start, and then Keir Tan will just take over from him when he is finished. Thanks, Madhu.
Thank you, Nunda. This talk was supposed to be an introductory talk to set the scene for this particular symposium on the challenges of diagnosing TB among individuals with HIV infection, and we plan to split this into two parts. In the first part, I will talk about how do conventional diagnostics perform in HIV-infected people, based on all the evidence that we have from the published literature. And then my colleague, Keaton Data from UCT, will talk about the new diagnostics that are in the pipeline and what he thinks is the potential these diagnostics have in HIV-infected persons. So what do we know about the performance of conventional and existing tools in HIV-infected people? Starting with smear microscopy, I don't think I need to convince you that smear microscopy performs very poorly in HIV-infected people. There's plenty of evidence from all over the world. And by definition, we cannot pick up smear-negative TB, which we know is one of the biggest problems with HIV-infected people, and it's often unhelpful in diagnosing extrapulmonary TB. Long diagnostic delays, as Peter Small so nicely put it, by the time you end up diagnosing TB in an HIV-infected person, they could die. So that is one of the biggest crises we have in terms of TB in sub-Saharan Africa. So while we are waiting for the perfect, nice, magic test to come along, the issue that came up a couple of years ago is that what can we do to optimize smear microscopy and make it work better, especially in HIV-infected populations? So a lot of effort went into producing three systematic reviews, which have been quite instrumental in informing policy. This was work largely funded by TDR and involved FIND and investigators from UC San Francisco and many other places, including WHO. And all these have been published. And the crux of this is that if you did fluorescence microscopy instead of Ziehr-Neelsen, if you did sputum processing, for example, using bleach or centrifugation, or if you increase the number or decrease the number of smears, how would it help to increase the yield and sensitivity of microscopy? Now, if you look at the overall findings, we reported that fluorescence microscopy is more sensitive than Ziehr-Neelsen without too much of a loss in specificity. Sputum processing does help, although we have a hard time understanding what part of the sputum processing seems to work, but doing bleach or centrifugation does seem to help. And the third smear does not add much in most settings to the overall case detection. So these were very helpful in informing the revised WHO policy on microscopy. However, I must point out to you, I went back and looked carefully at these three reviews that we published as to how many of these studies came from HIV-infected people. Unfortunately, for sputum processing, only 2 out of 83 studies provided data on HIV-positive people. In fluorescence microscopy, only 2 out of 45 studies had data on HIV-infected people. And in terms of 3 versus 2 smears, only 3 studies were done in HIV-infected people. So although we have fairly reasonable evidence on these smear optimization, virtually none of the studies have actually been done in HIV-infected persons. So my take-home message on this is that, yes, fluorescence microscopy and bleach centrifugation do seem to increase the yield in HIV-infected, but I would rate this as very weak evidence. The 2 of the 3 studies in HIV-positive persons showed no significant benefit in examining the third smear, but again, I would claim that the evidence is really weak. So although we have kind of shifted our smear policy largely based on the basis of these reviews, I would still suggest that we need to look at the HIV-infected group a little bit more carefully and make sure our new policies are indeed beneficial in those populations. So bottom line is that we badly need evidence on how to enhance microscopy in HIV-infected persons. The WHO policies have been updated, and we need to wait and watch how these play out in high HIV endemic settings. Hyliasis will talk about the new WHO algorithm on how to improve diagnosis of smear-negative TB. TDR has put in a lot of effort to come up with smear optimization in 19 different countries where trial sites have been set up to examine fluorescence microscopy, bleach microscopy, and so on. And as you have heard during this meeting, FIND is working with other groups to improve LED-based fluorescence microscopy. So there's clearly a lot of interest in enhancing microscopy, and we need to see how this works out in HIV-infected populations. In terms of cultures, we all know that the push towards widespread implementation of cultures was in part driven by the HIV epidemic and the fact that we needed to do better than microscopy in most HIV-infected populations. And this data is from the report that was submitted to the expert group to WHO, which suggests that liquid culture systems in general increase the yield by about 10%, but there are caveats. One would need to worry about contamination. One, of course, would need to worry about a widespread implementation and laboratories that don't have the capacity to do liquid cultures. With all those caveats, I think there is more excitement about using cultures, especially in high HIV prevalence settings. Find BD Midget projects data are coming in. The new WHO policy on cultures is already up. And this document, I would think, is probably the best evidence source right now on what exactly cultures can do in HIV-infected persons. That was a report submitted to the expert group earlier this year. Nucleic acid amplification tests, again, are very promising in theory, especially if they work well in smear-negative TB, which we know is a problem in HIV-infected people. More than 250 studies have been published world over. They've all been synthesized very nicely in a series of systematic reviews. The news is not good. Existing NATs, although they have fairly high specificity, existing NATs have poor and highly variable sensitivity. Sensitivity is especially lower in extrapulmonary TB and smear-negative TB, and we already know that's the biggest challenge with HIV-infected populations. They're expensive, and they have limited applicability in countries with high HIV prevalence. So a lot more effort is being put in by a whole a number of parties to develop new NACs, and Rick O'Brien and Keithan will talk about them, including the LAMP assay and the Cepheid assay. But all new NAC platforms will need to be evaluated, particularly in HIV-infected people, to see whether their sensitivity will be sustained in those populations. Serological tests for TB, again, are very attractive in principle, especially if they can be made into point-of-care dipstick or a lateral flow assay. And they have been around for a long time. I don't consider them new. And we published two meta-analyses recently, again, supported by TDR. And the news is that serological tests, the existing tests, have failed completely, especially in HIV-infected populations. And there's very little evidence that existing serological tests are helpful in HIV-infected populations. So again, as in the case of NAT, a lot more work is going in to try and bring back serological tests to a level that could potentially perform well. You know, there are nicely performing assays in bovine and primate TB, for example, based on the lateral flow technologies, but all of them will be a challenge to implement in HIV-infected people. So FIND, for example, is working on improving antigens, improving the platforms to detect antibody and antigen responses, and the LAM assay is already being evaluated. So we would need to wait and watch how these serological tests work out in HIV-infected populations. Right now, we don't have enough data. The tuberculin skin test is another existing test. We know it underperforms in HIV-infected people because of energy. We know it cannot distinguish between LTBI and active TB. And we know specificity is poor, especially if BCG is given after infancy or if it is given multiple times. And there's been a lot of excitement about interferon gamma release assays and how they will perform in HIV-infected people, whether they could be used for detecting active TB in HIV-infected people. This meta-analysis was published earlier this year in the Annals, and FIND and Stop TB published this research agenda in the Lancet on how T-cell assays should be improved and what the research needs are. And one of the biggest conclusions or recommendations in this research agenda was that we need data in HIV-infected people. So overall, if you look at IGRAs, I think there's convincing evidence of high specificity. BCG seems to have very little effect on IGRA performance. In terms of sensitivity, I would think that IGRAs are at least as sensitive as TST, but I think ELISpot has the potential to be more sensitive than skin test. Both IGRAs, I think there's emerging data, appear to be more sensitive than the TST in immunocompromised, with ELISpot showing a higher yield in immunocompromised than QuantiFERON. But indeterminate results are an issue, especially those with CD4 counts less than 200. So based on this, the recommendation that we made in this paper was that we need large-scale field demonstration projects, especially in issues in HIV-infected populations. Are they feasible, first of all? Will they enhance the use of IPT? Will IGRAs aid active TB diagnosis in HIV-infected kids and contacts? Those are the issues we need to sort out. FIND, for example, is supporting a whole series of QuantiFERON projects in high HIV burden settings, including the CREATE ZAMSTAR, SACV projects at the Institute here in Cape Town. So we would have to wait and watch how these data play out to be able to make an informed decision on whether IGRAs will or will not work out in HIV-infected persons. I'll now invite Keithan to continue with the new tools.
Thanks, Madhu. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak today. And you've already heard from Madhu about several of the existing tests, and I'm just going to take a little bit of a crystal ball approach and tell you about the potential utility of some of these tests that are in the pipeline. So this is just a quick overview of some of the tests I'll briefly talk about, and then a summary slide and what I think about applicability of these tests in a high-burden setting. So some of you have already heard about LED technology. Has been mentioned a couple of times during this meeting, and this consists of a diode that emits light in the same absorbance spectrum as Auramine, and this is appealing as it will make fluorescence microscopy more feasible in developing countries. And as you've probably heard, FIND is engaged in demonstration projects planned for 2008. And in fact, you can view this technology in Hall 1B at the Zeiss stand. In contrast, the autoamine staining with the UV microscope, which you can see in the left-hand panel, requires a darkroom, expensive mercury bulbs, and a reliable electrical supply. And you've also heard that serology has been very disappointing both in HIV positive and negative subjects, and is it perhaps better to look for antigen? And this is the urine LAM test from Chemagen, which detects LAM antigen by ELISA in the urine. Urine, for obvious reasons, is an optimal specimen, and in a high HIV prevalence population, in about 119 co-infected patients, the sensitivity of this test in a published study was 81%. In another study published in abstract form, again a high population with a high seroprevalence of HIV, the sensitivity was 73%. Obviously, it would be very useful if this test platform could be simplified, and in fact, that's exactly what has happened. And this is the urine LAM ICT strip test, and a positive result is denoted by an extra red stripe on this nitrocellulose strip, much like you get on the pregnancy strip tests. And this is obviously a potential point of care test because it takes only 20 minutes and no specific lab skills are needed. And we're currently evaluating this test in an ongoing study in Cape Town. I'm just going to briefly mention simplified liquid culture media, and there are several commercial and non-commercial agents that can be added to culture to make detection more rapid. And this is TK medium, and the mycobacterial metabolites cause a color change before the colonies actually appear, but there's currently no data on the performance outcome of this test. Now, you've already heard about MODS several times during this meeting. And for those of you who are not familiar with this test, mycobacteria grow more rapidly in liquid media and are detectable earlier using an inverted light microscope. And this is the basic principles under which the test operates. The sensitivity has been excellent, as you've already probably heard several times now in this study in the New England Journal of Medicine from David Moore. And in a subgroup in this paper, there were HIV patients which were looked at, and you can see in this right-hand panel that MODS performed extremely well, slightly better than automated liquid culture and solid media. Moving on to the nucleic acid amplification test platforms, this is LAMP, or loop-mediated isothermal amplification. It's a rapid test, isothermal, so you don't need a thermal cycler as in conventional PCR, high throughput, and it can use clinical samples as well. A recent publication established feasibility in high-burden settings, and sensitivity from preliminary data is approximately 50% in smear-negative TB, but there's no data in HIV-positive subjects. And this is the CAFEID system, which has also briefly been mentioned earlier on, and this uses real-time PCR and molecular beacons, and there's a simple preparation protocol, and you can actually put the sample into these cartridges, and you can get a result in 2 hours. This is still in the developmental phase with clinical trials planned apparently for next year, so there's no data in HIV-positive or negative patients. Just to quickly mention two experimental approaches, we're currently looking at the utility of PCR to detect mycobacterial DNA in the urine in conjunction with Jim Huggett and Ali Zumla at UCL. And very intriguing is the electronic nose technology, where adsorption of organic compounds onto a gas sensor by gas chromatography converts a chemical signature into an electronic pattern. And this is still in development, but conceptually it's a very attractive point of care test if it works out. Mothers already mentioned that you cannot distinguish latent from active TB using the interferon gamma release assays, but it is possible using cells from the site of disease to make a diagnosis, and this is just some of our preliminary data from pleural fluid. And if you look at the first two columns on the left-hand side, you can see different antigens like ESAT6 and CFP10 can distinguish reasonably well from TB and non-TB pleural effusions. So this is a study that's ongoing. So in summary, I think to improve the diagnosis, we all agree that we need new tests in HIV-positive patients. The challenge is going to be how best to incorporate these new tests into management algorithms. What do I think about the potential of these new tests? For point of care tests, I think the LAM ICT looks very promising if the data can be borne out. LED technology, no doubt, will make SMEAR more feasible. In Africa, with respect to secondary and tertiary care facilities, I think MODS looks very promising and requires evaluation in some kind of a standardized or kit format. The midget rollout that's been spearheaded by FINE will obviously be crucial to identify limitations that need to be addressed in high-burden settings. With regard to PCR, my own feeling is that there might be some limitations brought about by sensitivity issues, cost and feasibility, but I think that remains to be seen. And the IGRAs may be useful in a specific context in probably tertiary care centers in specific patients. Just to remind ourselves that, of the very difficult circumstances under which many of our patients live, though we are fortunate in South Africa in having relatively better equipped laboratories. And this is just a table showing you in the second column that many African countries, in fact, don't have access to fluorescence microscopy, and culture is either not available at all in the national programs or there's very limited access to culture. And there's very basic laboratory facilities and clinics in many parts of Africa. And so to end, just to say that given the sparse infrastructure, widespread implementation, I think, of complex diagnostic tests will be very challenging. Secondly, we have to bear in mind that most healthcare workers in these clinics are nurses, not doctors. And finally, I think before we can even think of these new diagnostic tests, we have to bear in mind that there's an urgent need to strengthen laboratory infrastructure and capacity and roll out and expand microscopy and culture facilities, as was emphasized in the plenary session yesterday. So I thank you for your attention, and we'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. You guys really motored. So we have time. I'll allow two questions if there are burning issues, but we will also have a panel discussion at the end. So you can also write down your questions. Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Kirtan. You staged it very nicely for our next speaker, who will talk. It's an old friend of mine, and in fact, he's not Jerome, he's Jeremiah. I thought I was getting old and I forgot his name, but he's Jeremiah Chakaya, who will talk on assuring HIV screening and care for TB patients. And Jeremiah comes from Kenya, so we're looking forward. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thank you. Thank you. First, I'd like to thank the organizers of this symposium for the opportunity to speak about a subject that is very close to my... I will. Most of the things I'm going to tell you today are basically personal experiences as the manager of the National TB Control Program at a time when the program was trying to roll out TB HIV collaborative activities. I think it's important because Madhuk introduced me as the director of the NTP. I think it's important to know that I'm not the director of the NTP anymore. I stopped being that about a year ago, but yes, I'm still fairly closely linked to the program in Kenya. Now, what are the kind of issues that we are dealing with in places like Kenya, and I guess really for the most of sub-Saharan African countries? I think the first thing that we are in Africa dealing with is a massive increase in the burden of TB that has occurred over the last 1.5 decade or so. And most of us, of course, believe that that has been primarily because of the HIV problem. If you look at adult HIV prevalence in most African countries, they did the kind of thing that you see on this chart. Prevalence tipped at about mid-1995-1996. And since then, in most African countries, we're beginning to see some degree of lowering of or decline in the prevalence of HIV in the adult population, which is a good thing. Now, as you all know, and this has been presented in this meeting many times, and I think most of us are very familiar with this, there's a bit of a lag phase between the introduction of HIV into the community and the increase in HIV in the population. I think this is very well demonstrated in this graph, where you can see our HIV rates went up very quickly, but the TB rates slackened a little bit until about 1994, 1995, and started going up, and are still going up to date. So, what did we do then in terms of TB HIV service provision? From about the middle of 2005, the middle half of 2005, Kenya was able to record systematically what we were doing with HIV testing and provision of cotrimoxazole and provision of antiretroviral treatment to its TB patients. And from that quarter, you can see that over the last 1.5 years, HIV testing has moved up from about 30% of TB patients in the third quarter of 2005 to nearly 80% by the second quarter of 2007. If you look at the proportion of patients who are testing positive for HIV, we started off with a rate of about 60% for TB patients, and that came down a little bit and seems to be stabilizing at about 50-52% or so. In terms of the proportion of patients who are HIV infected and who are provided with cotrimoxazole preventive therapy, that went up very rapidly over the last over the first 1 year when we were able to collect this information, and it seems to have stabilized at about 85% or so. While ART, on the other hand, has remained fairly stagnant. We started off with about 25% of HIV-infected patients receiving ART, and we haven't really moved up. I mean, it's creeping up a little bit to about 30% now, but it's not anywhere near what it should be, because as we all know, all HIV-infected TB patients ideally should be provided with antiretroviral treatment. Now, if you look at the kind of things that we do in terms of the facilities that are providing the various forms of TB-HIV-related activities, most hospitals are providing HIV testing. Some health centers, about 2/3 of them, are providing HIV testing. But where the majority of patients are going, which is in the dispensaries or so, a very small proportion of those are providing HIV testing. Sputum smear microscopy currently, this is by the end of 2006, was provided in about 770 facilities, while TB treatment sites where patients are able to pick up their medicines, almost 2,000 such facilities are able to do that. But you only have in the country by December 2006, only about 320 sites providing ART services. So a very big discrepancy between the TB services and the HIV testing services and the places where people can actually receive ART services. But the ART program is young in most African countries, including Kenya. By 2002, we only had 5 pilot sites. And I think a lot of African countries have made very good progress and quite rapid progress for that matter, in that, for example, in my country, by March 2007, almost 348 sites were providing ART services for adults, and about 199 were able to provide ART services for children. So we are fairly confident that we have made some good progress with TB-HIV collaborative activities in terms of the provision of HIV testing and providing cotrimoxazole preventive therapy to our patients. And the reasons behind this is what I would want to explore with you over the next few minutes or so. I think the first major reason was the presence of robust policies for TB-HIV collaborative activities. And I'm really happy that World Health Organization was able to come up with a crisp document on the key issues that need to be done at country level to make TB-HIV services available to people who need those services. I think also in a country like Kenya, the presence of guidelines for HIV testing in clinical settings was a major landmark that really enables us to move forward with HIV testing for our TB patients. We issued this document in 2004. It did emphasize that if we don't offer HIV testing to people who are presenting to healthcare facilities with an illness that could be HIV infected, is actually substandard care. And I think that really provided a stimulus for a lot of clinicians to start providing HIV testing to their patients. We wouldn't have been able to pick up this data if we did not revise our recording and reporting system. And yes, in 2005, in the last half of that year, we were able to push to all healthcare facilities that were managing TB patients a new recording and reporting system that included TB HIV indicators. For example, whether the HIV test has been done or not, whether people have been given cotrimoxazole or not, or whether people have been given ART. I think that was also a major landmark that led to the kind of things that we are now seeing in Kenya. We wouldn't have been able to do this if we were not committed to it, and I think the NLTP took it to heart to make sure that some of these things happened, and we had the support of the HIV-AIDS control program, although we were fighting small leadership wars, but in the long run, I think we were in it together, and we did manage to push together. I think another important thing that we did was target setting. We did set national targets. We set for the regions, and the regions set for themselves targets, and there were district targets, and there were targets even at local service provision sites. I think those are very, very important things. So we talked about this, we set targets, and people started chasing those targets, and I think that was very, very crucial in giving us the targets that we got. Then there was healthcare worker training. We did, with the help of a lot of our partners, World Health Organization and CDC and many others, we developed a standardized way of training our healthcare workers and disseminated this document to literally all the regions for a standardized approach to the training or retraining of healthcare workers who are involved in the provision of TB HIV services. Recently, we have started some communication strategies to telling everybody that if you do have TB, you could be HIV infected. And these messages are coming out in the mass media. We have billboards telling people to do this kind of thing. And I'm confident that some of this is having the impact that that we want, that many more people are now not shying away from getting tested for HIV. We needed money to do this, and I'm glad that we had lots of partners that supported us and are still supporting us in driving this agenda forward. So we have, for example, We Are PEPFAR Country, we had the Global Fund, we had USAID, we had CEDA through KNCV, WHO, and many others. But as you see in this slide, we don't always have enough money. By the end of 2006, that country had about 50% of the funds that it required to do a comprehensive approach to TB and HIV control in that country. I think one of the key issues also that we managed to have is partnership for results. I mean, we had a lot of partners working in the country, all trying to do all sorts of things, but all having the same goal of making sure that HIV-infected TB patients are tested for HIV and receiving treatment. We had, for example, technical expertise from WHO. We had technical expertise from KNCV. We had technical expertise from CDC. And we had a lot of implementing partners at ground level. I think this work would not have been done and maybe cannot be done if it was only the NTP that was doing this work alone. What about the human resource issues? As you know, Kenya is among those countries that is having severe human resource issues. There are major human resource deficiencies within the healthcare system. And unfortunately, where people go, especially where the poor go, that's where the human resource deficiencies are most severe. The human resource distribution currently in that country favors urban centers because everybody wants to work in better places where they do not have to suffer the social difficulties that rural living sometimes leads to. highly agricultural potential areas tend to have a lot more health resources than those that are arid and semi-arid. And Kenya is basically like two-thirds of it is arid and semi-arid. So human resource disparities that make it sometimes very difficult to organize services in an effective way. What did we do in terms of getting to improve our human resource issues? Using the support from the Intensive Support and Action Countries, which was a Stop TB Partnership Initiative, and from PEFR, as a program, we were not able, of course, to sort out all the human resource issues at healthcare level, so we couldn't get clinicians and nurses and what have you to place in our healthcare facilities. But we were able to get additional coordinators, and we got about 36 young people who really stimulated action at basic health units. These young people had one single mandate when they went out there, that we wanted to see action, we wanted to see movement as far as TB HIV activities were concerned. And I think they have had that impact in a very big way. Okay, like I have already said, yes, technical support and supervision. People in my country do not like the word supervision because it means you do not know what you're doing, so somebody has to come from outside and tell you what to do. But technical support sounds like a better word to use. And yes, we did develop standardized approaches, guidelines and checklists for supervision. We provided finances for regular technical support, formed teams of in-country technical agencies, and I think we were very impressed with the performance of these teams, because for once we were able to go out into the country all at once, because you have like five teams of people made up of CDC, FHI, all sorts of people interested in TB, HIV, or going out there to support regions and districts to come up with the kind of results that we got. Again, going back to the human resource issues, we've had several studies in Kenya that show very clearly that people out there working in healthcare facilities are demotivated because conditions are not very good and the pay is not very good and things like that. And therefore we thought and we said, what can we do to motivate people to get better results? And we started something that we called an award scheme to recognize people, to encourage a bit of competition among healthcare workers, and we hope that this was going to give us a better productivity. The first performance awards we carried out was in 2008. For example, the gentleman on your left-hand side was designated the best provincial coordinator for that year. And we carried out a new set of these awards in 2006, and here we recognize teams. So this was the winning province being given some certificate by the Deputy Minister for Health, which was quite something. Then we had the winning facility for the 2005 award. And I think this also, all these things had an impact on the results that we got. Among the things that are outlined in the interim policy for TB HIV collaborative is planning and coordination. And we did try and do some of those things. We established coordinating committees at all levels. We know at this moment in time that the National Committee is working very well, and we know that the committees at district and regional levels are not working very well, but we are doing everything we can to make sure that that situation improves. Joint planning between TB and HIV, because of the organizational structure within the Minister of Health, is still a bit of a problem, but we hope we can improve that. And we are trying to strengthen links between the TB and HIV programs. So in summary, ladies and gentlemen, we think in Kenya we have made some good progress with HIV testing of our TB patients. We are providing cotrimoxazole preventive therapy to a significant number of our HIV-infected TB patients. We certainly are not satisfied that 15% of our patients or so who should be receiving a very simple intervention like cotrimoxazole are still not receiving this intervention for reasons that we do not know at this moment in time. We are not satisfied at this moment in time with the proportion of our TB patients who are receiving antiretroviral treatment, even though the absolute numbers have gone up. We know that the TB control program doesn't have this in its hands itself, but working together with our HIV control program, we hope we can start integrated centers where TB and HIV services will be given in the same facility, because at this moment in time, the TB program is only able to test people for HIV, provide them with cotrimoxazole treatment, and then refer them to ART centers, and a lot of patients get lost in that process. So we are thinking, and we have started then sites, pilot sites, where integrated TB-HIV services are being provided. We believe that we will not be able to give all our patients or provide ART services to all our patients with TB and HIV unless the HIV program or ART program is decentralized to the lowest level, as the TB program is currently decentralized. And then finally, we hope that with all the things that we are doing, we should be able to get to the big prize, which is universal access to TB-HIV services by 2010, which is a target that we have set for ourselves and has been set by others on our behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Any questions or comments? Yes. Just as you get to the microphone, just introduce yourself.
Umesh Lalu from Durban, South Africa. Have you considered the opt-out option for HIV testing, whereby patients get tested unless they refuse to? Because that seems to be the most logical way to go, providing you can bridge all the human rights issues.
That's what we do, actually. We used to call it initially diagnostic counseling and testing, which means everybody is offered the HIV test unless they do not want to get the test. So I think these days the term that's used is provide initiated HIV testing with an opt-out option. That's what we do.
Thank you for the presentation. My name is Thomas Ovilarazi. I'm from South Africa. Thank you for all the hard work in implementing TB and HIV collaborative activities. I'm just concerned about the role of the HIV AIDS program, the National AIDS program, in this, particularly referring to the revision of your recording and reporting system. What about the HIV? Did they revise theirs? How do you get information on the screening of HIV positives for TB, for example? Thank you.
Good question, and it's something that we struggled with because we haven't actually done much there. Maybe tell you a little bit about the organizational structure of the TB program in Kenya. The TB program was in the same division. Well, it was. Now there are two separate divisions. It's in the same division as the HIV program, and we had We answer to the same head and stuff like that, but during the revision of the TB recording and reporting forms, that was primarily done by the TB program. The HIV program has also got its recording and reporting forms in place, but they did not include TB work. And now they are revising their recording and reporting tool again. And this time we are involved in that process, and the TB issues will be put in that. Now, the important thing about that is that at this moment in time, we cannot tell you anything about the proportion of HIV-infected individuals who get a TB screen. We can't tell you that at all, because that is not picked up in HIV clinics. But we hope after we have revised the reporting tools that we should be able to tell you what proportion of HIV-infected individuals are getting screened for TB, and maybe then we can start a good IPT program because we have a good reporting system to base it on.
Thank you. In the interest of time, I have to call stop here, but I think perhaps in the discussions afterwards, the problem that you mentioned, Jeremiah, it's a problem in South Africa, in all the other countries I've spoken to. It is a huge problem. There is no monitoring tool to see how many people who go to VCT centers are screened and tested for TB. And perhaps we can have another discussion about that later. Then it is my pleasure to invite Veronese Madison from Zambia to give her presentation on integrating TB and HIV diagnostics for improved care and treatment support in Zambia. Thank you, Veronese.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to you about some of the logistics and the work that has been going on in Zambia for a number of years, actually, with the Ministry of Health and the National AIDS Council. A number of people in Zambia were working on some of the training materials with the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, and other partners. And this particular diagram here just illustrates the door that's open from an HIV counseling and testing result. And as you can see, no matter whether it's positive or negative, a lot of activities are put in place. And so in particular, one of the things that we focused on more recently is looking at the TB-HIV integration activities. And in doing that, what I'd like to do today is just approach some of the logistical issues that we look at. And more recently, Zambia has changed the algorithm, or modified the algorithm for HIV testing from the actual blood draw to the finger prick. And so we're dealing with some of the logistics of that and sample collection. We're also dealing with when other blood tests are being ordered, requested, like RPR tests and things like that. We're also looking at counseling and testing space. We're also looking, obviously, at the TB sample collection, sample transport, if the space for smear microscopy is inadequate. And as well, we're looking at staffing for smear microscopy services. Now, some of those services are being done in collaboration with each other. We probably still have a lot further to go than we have come, but we have gotten off to a very good start. Some of the laboratory logistics, if the tests are being done in the laboratory, are from the patient-client registry aspect, and we do have some management data systems being put in place. We have the input of a widespread smart card that's being innovated and developed for implementation throughout the country. And so we will be picking up data as time goes by. But we're looking at preparation, some of the logistics we're looking at in terms of the laboratory, in terms of human resources, is who will prepare and read and interpret the AFB smears. We're also looking at how we can manage discordant results for confirmation, because a lot of times these are to be sent directly to the national reference laboratories, especially the HIV testing reference laboratory. So one of the things that's been very helpful to us are the rapid HIV training materials that have been developed by global partners. And about a year ago, Zambia started to customize these to suit the country need, and they've been very actively involved in trying to align these with stakeholder support and other sustainable proficiency goals with staff and staff turnover, which most countries have to deal with. So just last week, we just finished the rapid HIV training, and in another few weeks, some of our partners and staff will attend the TB-HIV training in Uganda. But this is sort of the overall strategy that we in Zambia have been looking at. Things from, obviously, from the national policy level, partners trying to support basic infrastructure, human resources, the supply chain, and laboratory quality assurance system. So I'd like to just share a few things with you in regard to what we have achieved and what we look forward to doing in Zambia in the future. HIV counseling and testing, or DCT, was actually started in about 2004 And this was kind of initiated as a project at the Livingstone General Hospital, which is in a very high HIV prevalence area. So diagnostic and counseling testing modules have been developed for Zambia. And I hope that most of you were able to see the Zambia posters, S96 and S256. If not, please refer to those in your program bulletins for data and for some of the outcome results. Another thing that we were doing about the same time where we were implementing fluorescent microscopy in Zambia in a number of sites. And fluorescent microscopy has been available in Zambia at our National Reference Laboratory and the University Teaching Laboratory for several years. But we thought we would try to extend that type of support and speed up the diagnosis and the sensitivity of detection of TB at the provincial laboratory. So we did that. At this time, we've extended fluorescent microscopes, and these, of course, are the conventional fluorescent microscopes to 7 laboratories. And in order to implement that kind of thing, what we've done was to do fluorescent microscopy on-site training. We've done general training, of course, quality control, and we've also developed training materials for the maintenance of the fluorescent microscope. In starting this, one of the things that we did was to do a validation of fluorescence microscopy and Zill-Nielsen smear microscopy with specimens in duplicate, because we were concerned about how well people would actually, the technologists would actually take to this new technique. And we blinded the specimens and actually showed them what the results were for improving their time or decreasing the amount of time that they had involved with the testing and also for the number of tests that they were able to detect as positive. We were able to look at things like water and water filtration to be sure that we weren't picking up other non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And so we did see a decrease in the time. And we've been able to increase some of the fluorescence microscopy training at other sites. And we've also looked at a couple of different type of conventional fluorescent microscopes, but we do look forward to the new scopes that are out. But we were able to increase the positive test results up to 40% in some areas. And, of course, some of those were just scanty results or even the increase in the number of quantitation scales from a 1+ to a 2+. So we were very pleased. To just look a little bit further in terms of how we are integrating and have opportunities to integrate more in Zambia is we've been able to integrate rapid culture or have culture capacity in Zambia at 5 labs, and particularly the Chest Disease National Laboratory and the newly developed Regional Reference Lab, the University Teaching Hospital, and in 2 other labs, the Centers for Infectious Disease Research and 1 Mission Hospital, which has very good capacity in a more rural area. So in integrating these, we look forward to the new fluorescent options that we now have available and what plans might be able to be done with fluorescence microscopy and improving the turnaround time. We certainly also will look at the possibility that there will be a lot of need for training and monitoring to maintain sustainability and to look at integrated courier and sample transport. That's another thing that we're looking at in training for safe packaging and delivery of samples. We're actually integrating this along with dry blood spot for PMTCT and HIV testing in that particular aspect. So we look forward to the coordination of rapid HIV, TB quality assurance and the data collection tools and continuous quality monitoring. Now, just to acknowledge some of our partners, a few of them I did forget and leave off of it, but the Zambia PEPFAR partners for HIV-CT and PMT-CT, of course, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Zambia, as well as Atlanta, USAID, TBCAP, Japan, JICA, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Foundation for Innovative Diagnostics and New Diagnostics, Zambart, The Becton Dickinson Company, both in South Africa and Maryland, have been very, very helpful. And we started with this project, for the most part, or implementation of this with ORISE fellows. And more recently, the American Society for Microbiology has been very, very helpful. The University of Alabama, Elizabeth Glazer and Siders in Zambia has also been very helpful. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Berenice. Are there any questions? Thanks, Madhu.
Thank you, Berenice. I was just wondering if you or any other African country that you know of has tried to use the rapid oral fluid-based diagnostics instead of the finger prick. We've tried them out in India in one rural site, and they were exceptionally sensitive and specific, 100% sensitive and specific, took about 20 minutes, and HIV patients consistently preferred oral fluid testing over finger prick. So I was wondering if you had any experience or you're aware of any other African country that's even trying to use oral fluid HIV diagnostics.
I have heard of a couple of countries that have been working on it. I don't want to call the country name, but however, there has been a project in Zambia that has done that, and I think they're really looking more carefully at it and will probably present the data. There is a paper that's published, and particularly, I think, with pediatrics. So it does have great potential.
Jonas?
Hi. Maybe a quick comment on that. From some of the meetings preceding this, there has been discussion we still need the guidance out for the EQA for fluorescent microscopy, but I did want to mention, I know Armand Van Doon and others are looking at immediate guidelines, but technically, if people are interested, the current thought is not to overstain with Seal Nelson. A lot of people think that, but that's a less sensitive stain. So they're actually looking at overstaining or restaining with Oramine O before rechecking a sample, you know, as opposed to waiting to next year to look at this. And I think that works reasonably well. And I also wanted to mention, in terms of fluorescence, this is a common, is that actually Berenice, when she worked at CDC Atlanta, one of her projects is she developed a national training tool for fluorescent microscopy. So it's sort of the challenge. There's actually things out there that would need to be converted from like the ATS scale to the WHO scale, but there are things there, and that's a challenge, I think, to keep moving this forward.
Thank you, John. And I also wanted to say, since that time in country, we have worked and developed a fluorescent microscopy maintenance program for the conventional microscope, but hopefully with the new microscopes coming online, maybe they won't be quite as much needed, especially one of the challenges with conventional fluorescent microscopy is changing the bulbs and for those two different types of scopes. Anything else?
Thank you.
Any
other questions? I see nobody further. Thank you. And then I will hand over to Jeremiah.
Thank you. We now move to Dr. Heliesas from WHO, who will tell us something about the new algorithm for the diagnosis of smear negative TB and extrapulmonary forms of TB.
Thank you very much. In the last union meeting, I presented almost a near final policy that we were working on, and I thank the organizers for inviting me to present the progress in implementing that policy just in less than 1 year time, which is not a very common thing. My presentation I'll give a quick summary of the recommendations and will also describe the methodology we used to assess the implementation, and I will give a few information and then the challenge and conclude. The smear negative recommendations were developed because of increased problem linked with TB diagnosis, particularly in people living with HIV. And the main focus of those recommendations was to avert unnecessary deaths and really to speed up the diagnosis. And these recommendations were targeted both for national AIDS program and TB control program. And the key recommendations include the revision of case definition, stating that the number of smear to define a smear positive case, and also the number of smear that needs to be done to diagnose TB and HIV positive. And also we developed algorithms and tailored to the clinical condition of the patient, whether the patient is acutely sick looking or clinically well. And it also suggests HIV testing to be done for TB suspects, not only TB patients, and also the established minimum number of visits that a patient should have before the TB is diagnosed. This was set in order to expedite the diagnosis. And as part of increasing the sensitivity of the investigations, and all available investigations were suggested as early as possible, including chest X-ray and culture. Moreover, for those sick patients, particularly at peripheral health facilities, flexibility to start empiric treatment was also recommended. And TB care should also include HIV care, like HIV staging, so that to set for antiretrovirals and managing of PCP and cotrimoxazole preventive therapy. And also, clinical management of extrapulmonary TB were also recommended as part of routine TB control activities, and also suggested to improve recording and reporting of SMIN-negative TB, which was not the case before. So the background, as I said, it was finalized and made available in November 2006, and after it's finalized, we disseminated using the electronic as well as print media, and we shared it with TV and TV and HIV meetings, and it was available in multiple languages, English, Spanish, French, and we also come to know later it was translated by independent groups and available on the web in Portuguese and Indonesian. And we also shared it during the Round 6 Global Fund preparation in order to encourage countries to apply through the Global Fund for the implementation of these recommendations. And also it was included in the TB-HIV co-management manual of the IMEI series, which is HIV department's module for HIV programs. But we know implementation of global policy has to be adapted into national policy before being implemented, and this is usually a very procedural and long process. So what we did in our methodology to see the implementation of this algorithm is to have interview with 20 national TB control program managers from Africa, which contributes for 60% of the global TB HIV burden. And we also analyzed Global Fund Round 6 TB and HIV proposals from 63 countries in order to see what components of these recommendations were included in those proposals. We also look at PEPFAR 2007 PLASA proposals and also the implementation of the IMEI incorporating these recommendations. What we look specifically was whether the recommended policy issues were embraced by these activities, like the case definition and provision of HIV testing, and also the algorithms, and also on the current status and future plans around expansion and decentralization of culture and chest X-ray facilities, and also to get the perspective of the TB control program managers around the extent of the problem and the challenges they face in terms of implementing these recommendations. So when we see the key activities in terms of implementing, it's very interesting that it's only one of the 20 NTP managers who was not aware of these changes, these recommendations. And one thing which may be useful was the recommendations were developed through a transparent and participatory web-based consultation so that most NTP managers were part of the development process. So when, in terms of looking currently going on revision of national policies through TB guidelines, about 45% of countries are currently revising their policy to include these SMIR negative recommendations. And culture was available in 16 out of the 20 countries, at least one. And there are 75% of the countries, 15 out of the 20, are having plans to decentralize culture facilities, and only 20% have the expansion for just X-ray. Similarly, when we see the plans for decentralization of culture facilities, it ranges between 1 into 6 additional culture facilities. When we see the Global Fund round 6, there were 35 TB proposals in which 88% include TB HIV component and 33 HIV proposals, out of which 42 include TB HIV components. And expansion of HIV testing is the key component of this Global Fund proposals. When we see specifically for culture, chest X-ray, and other investigations for extrapulmonary, it's interesting that 11% included expansion of culture as case detection, and 6% chest X-ray expansion, and only 3% included investigations for extrapulmonary like biopsy and ultrasound and the other related investigations. Unfortunately, none of the HIV proposals included these investigations. When we see the PEPFAR 2007 plus up plans of selected countries, we come to know that expansion of fluorescence microscopy, chest X-ray, and also decentralization of culture facilities, as well as extra pulmonary TB investigations were included. And further to this specific recommendation-related activities, there were other activities that are included in this PEPFAR plans, like support for laboratory supplies and management, quality assurance for smear microscopy, and training of health workers both in microscopy as well as culture and X-ray. When we see the implementation of the IMAI TB-HIV co-management manual, it has been adopted in these 6 countries, in Nigeria, Ghana, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Guyana, and currently plans are going on to adopt these recommendations and this IMAI guideline in Uganda, Zambia, Sudan, and Somalia. The importance of this IMAI TB-HIV co-management is the stakeholders are purely HIV stakeholders, so this helps to roll out it through the HIV service providers. The challenges identified by the National TB Control Program managers were they all acknowledge the extent of the problem and the advantage and crucial role of these recommendations to address the problem of diagnosis of TB in HIV positives. But national policy adaptation is apparently a very long and expensive process. Some of the countries who were not in the process of adapting their policies, what they said was they have just finished their revision, the revision of their TB guidelines just a year ago and 2 years ago, and they don't want to embark into a new policy formulation process that will have huge implication in terms of rolling out, including training cost, stuff, and also other activities. And training materials and technical assistance to roll out these new policies and their implementation was absent. And they also expressed concern over the human resource shortage and also particularly in the availability of expertise to roll out these investigations like the culture, the chest X-ray, and also the others. Moreover, they also said lack of operational guards, like standard operating procedures, how to expand and how to decentralize these investigations, and also a simple issue like having what is the unit cost of each of these investigations so that they can plan and really embark on scaling up their implementation. And there is a still perceived expensive cost of supplies and investigations, particularly for extrapulmonary disease, and who should be also responsible for buying, for example, a needle biopsy or ultrasound machine. And there is some concern and confusion around that inhibits its implementation. Likewise, concern who should pay for the investigations, the patient or the program, particularly for extrapulmonary and also chest X-ray and culture. This has also prohibited their rollout. And of course, the logistics issue, the long procurement procedures and administrative bottlenecks were also feared as one bottlenecks. Along with this, we encouraged also the operational evaluation of these recommendations, particularly to facilitate their implementation in collaboration with research groups and national HIV or TB control programs. And it's encouraging that currently operational evaluations to facilitate and expedite their implementation is going on in these countries: Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Zambia, Cambodia, and India. And this will further inform the programs how to facilitate the implementation of the recommendations. In conclusion, there is overall progress in the implementation of these recommendations, particularly when we consider the policy was just out a year ago, and there is emphasis on the expansion and decentralization of culture facilities. Of course, one can rightly argue that when we are enhancing the infrastructure for culture, we are also improving the infrastructure for simple procedures like smear microscopy. And Global Fund and PEPFAR offered good opportunities for the expansion of these recommendations. But unfortunately, uptake of these recommendations by National AIDS Program and HIV service providers is very limited, and tools and expertise and standard operating procedures, training manuals to expedite their implementation are largely needed. Thank you.
We will limit ourselves to one or two comments because we're running out of time. Maybe points of clarification, will allocate time at the end, hopefully, for more general discussion. Is there any points of clarification? Good. I think people have heard too many things over the last few days. So, okay, we move on now to the next presentation by Dr. Umesh Lalu from South Africa on the diagnosis of XTR-TB and the options that clinicians have.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and I think it's appropriate that a clinician talks, does one of the concluding talks. And in the audience is my mentor, Professor Margot Becklick, and it reminded me as a chest physician that in fact our roots in our subspecialty is in TB. And over the years, we actually abandoned our roots, and I would say at our peril, because you look at the mess we are with TB. What I'm going to do is, rather than go through the specific diagnostic option that we have for diagnosing XDR-TB, is to look at the issues. And the first question that comes to mind as a clinician is, was XDR-TB missed prior to the Tugela-Ferry study? And I'll illustrate with one or two case scenarios that this is probably the case. The next question a clinician will ask is, are there specific clinical clues to the presence of XDR-TB? And in a nutshell, the answer is no. Would reinforcing national TB control programs help to reveal cases earlier? And I think I'll make a strong case in this respect. And how may current diagnostics be applied to suspect XDR-TB earlier? And again, there the answer is very, very simply not possible, but I think if we apply some clinical acumen, we may use the current test to be able to diagnose or identify these patients earlier. Other issues that come to mind is, are XDR-TB strains acquired or ab initio? I.e., is this due to poor TB control program or is there a specific multi-drug resistant strain? And certainly, the studies in Tugela-Ferry suggest that whilst there is nosocomial transmission, many patients came in with the first episode of TB having XDR-TB. Now, whether this reflects community transmission or whether there's an ab initio strain, i.e. patients may be latently infected with an XDR strain. Are XDR strains more virulent, i.e. would we expect a more rapid clinical course and therefore identify these patients even before cultures become evident? We think it's unlikely, and certainly because most of the patients are HIV co-infected and at an advanced stage of HIV, it's very hard to dissect out whether the patient's clinical progression is due to the HIV or to the TB or both. So I don't think watching the clinical progress in the early weeks is going to help us to identify or suspect XDR-TB, and certainly the issue of iris makes it even more complex. I suppose the other question we often have to tackle with or deal with or grapple with is when we identify a patient with XDR-TB eventually, what do we do with the contacts? Should we apply a similar strategy that is proposed for multi-drug resistant TB, i.e. prophylaxis with a susceptible drug regimen? And clearly we probably have limited or no options because by definition the patients would be resistant to most of the easily and tolerable drugs. And even if we do embark on some form of prophylaxis, I don't think we know how long, and maybe we should wait for active disease, which could be a problem because further transmission may occur. I already raised the question of whether there is a latently infected pool of XDR-TB, and I don't think we know about this. I think the other challenge that many of us face, certainly in our setting, and certainly the Tugela-Ferry setting, is that there's a high mobility of patients, so patients may get diagnosed with TB, move to another center, deteriorate, and the clinician seeing the patient would not have the opportunity to witness a deterioration. Many of our patients do not have a fixed ID or present to different healthcare settings with different IDs, and therefore we do not have a registry through which to check with which clinic the patient went to get some information. We don't even know whether HIV is a high risk for XDR-TB. What we do know is that if you have HIV co-infection, the mortality is certainly remarkably high. South Africa is a high burden TB country, a TB burden country. And we follow the WHO recommendation, which says that because of the high burden, smear-positive cases, no culture should be done. And we've already heard about a new or revised smear-negative algorithm. But in this context, broad-spectrum antibiotics are prescribed, and frequently fluoroquinolones are used, which actually serves, I believe, to destroy one powerful group of antibiotics for TB, and XDR, by definition, is resistance to a fluoroquinolone. And I think the antibiotic algorithm should ideally propose that we should avoid the fluoroquinolones. Now, routine culture and sensitivity, if we do follow, it takes up to 8 weeks to make the diagnosis or recognize XDR-TB. And I think we also have a problem with communication with central laboratories. For example, in the Durban dish area, all the cultures are sent to a central laboratory. Now, unless the clinics have a very good communication network, many patients who turn out to have drug-resistant TB may not be identified. And I can give you a very simple scenario. I work at a tertiary institution where the laboratory is based. And I can give you one example. We did a bronchoscopy on a patient with smear-negative TB. The bronchoalveolar lavage was positive for TB. And the patient was commenced on TB treatment and referred to the clinic. The patient subsequently came back to us 3 months later in extremis, and my hospital keeps electronic records, so we do not get a hard copy of the information. And when we looked at the computer records of the patient, the lab had already recorded 2 months previously. The patient had multi-drug resistant TB, and there was no mechanism for the lab to contact the clinician or the clinic to which the patient was referred to inform them of the patient's culture and sensitivity status, and to the patient's detriment. And I think those are simple issues which do not need new diagnostic tests. It needs a better way of dealing with the current resources we have. Now, I'm not going to go through any details, but just to show you some of the definitions of TB resistance that are used, and I think you know all this, and therefore I won't go through it in detail. And again, I don't want you to go through this slide in any great detail, but I said that as a clinician, we need to know what clues there may be to recognize XDR-TB. And when you look at reports of drug-resistant TB preceding the revised case definition, you will see that XDR-TB, by the current definition, probably existed some time ago. And in fact, this study from South Korea, which is in the current clinical infectious disease issue, makes this point. What they did is effectively they looked retrospectively at all the cases of multi-drug resistant TB and found a substantially high number of patients with XDR-TB, which in itself was a determinant of outcome. The point I want to make is that this data was collected over a five-year period prior to the revised definition of XDR-TB, and that XDR-TB therefore existed long before the Tugela-Ferry exposure. And by way of a case study, I'd like to take the opportunity here to pay tribute to the Global Fund. I was the author of the Global Fund application for integrated HIV care in KwaZulu-Natal, for which we received $62 million for HIV care. And in fact, as a group, we received funding from the Harvard AIDS Institute to set up a comprehensive care program for HIV, and what we did include then, under the guidance of Professor Gerald Friedland, is a continuum of care program which included integrated TB and HIV. And the reason to show this is how the Tugela-Ferry story unfolded. In fact, what we did is we chose an urban site and subsequently a rural site to apply an integrated TB-HIV treatment program. At the urban site, we found that we had almost 100% cure rate for drug-sensitive TB and questioned whether such a strategy would work in a rural setting, and selected the Church of Scotland Hospital as the site because they were part of our team in the Global Fund application. You know that the Global Fund would not support research, and therefore the Doris Duke Research Foundation provided the research funding for this. And when we commenced the study, we found that despite a good immunologic response to antiretroviral treatment, patients were dying. And when I looked at the data, we realized that patients actually had multi-drug resistant TB. And we wrote up the first 6 cases and submitted to the Lancet, who fortunately rejected it because it spurred us on to look for more cases. And that's when the XDR study was formally done and exposed. And the point I'm trying to make from a clinical point of view is that when you are running a TB or HIV or integrated program, it makes good sense to do operational research because you might discover things that you did not expect. Now, coming down to the clinical setting, this is a patient, a nurse in fact, who was diagnosed as a smear-positive TB and failed to respond. We therefore thought that this may be drug-resistant TB, maybe an adherence problem. Because she was HIV co-infected, we thought there may be other complicating infections, including fungal pneumonia. This patient then had a bronchoscopy done and subsequently found to be, again, the fluid was positive and the culture revealed XDR-TB. Again, because our policy is not to culture smear-positive cases, the delay in diagnosing XDR-TB in this patient was of the order of 3 months. This patient subsequently demised. This is two slides, and this is a patient, the slides given to me by Prof. Friedland, and this is a patient from the Tugela-Ferry study. Now, on the first slide, you will see the patient who was diagnosed in January 2007 as drug-susceptible TB. Patient did very well, but in April 2007, the patient had what one might call a relapse. But what's very important is that you will see new infiltrates on the opposite lung. Now, clearly, as a clinician, you have to conclude that the patient was responding well to your anti-TB treatment and some new event had occurred. And because it was in the setting of HDR-TB, we suspected this early on, and obviously the culture and sensitivity proved that. So what I'm getting at is that it's very difficult to identify this patient's ab initio as having HDR-TB, even if you're working in the Church of Scotland Hospital, where we're seeing a large number of cases. And I don't think we can therefore treat all patients with HDR-TB simply because we have no therapeutic options in any case. And therefore, how do you recognize patients at risk? And I think the same criteria would apply in recognizing patients with multi-drug-resistant TB, and I've listed these there, which include where the patients have a poor adherence track record, where from a prescriber's point of view there were fundamental errors in treatment, or there was reduced bioavailability, for example, patients with advanced disease who may have malabsorption, there may be protein binding with other drugs. Some of the clinical indicators once you've started a patient on anti-TB treatment would be persistence of fever for several weeks, persistent sputum positivity at 2 months, and I think we therefore need careful follow-up of our patients to ensure that the 2 month repeat sputum is done. And when the patient has worsening clinical or radiologic parameters despite adequate therapy, whilst that is easier said than done, the point is that there are many other reasons than HDR-TB to explain this, simply MDR-TB or new infections in a patient who's already got advanced HIV disease. Drug resistance is also associated with residents in a region with a high incidence of MDR-TB, and I would add HDR-TB now, and patients who are not on a DOTS program. Transmission factors associated with hospitalization, as we've seen in the case studies in Church of Scotland, with incarceration, chronic care facilities, drug rehab and treatment facilities, and shelters for the homeless. Now, diagnostic tests for TB that the clinician may use, again, there are no new diagnostic tests that are immediately going to help alert you to the presence of HDR-TB at the outset, because our TB control programs are premised on smear positivity. The tuberculin skin test you've heard already is generally useless. IGRA also is not going to be of great value in this context. So basically, the clinician has to look at it this way. The fundamental diagnostic test in 1882 was the microscopy, and in 2007, it's still the same. So we haven't evolved much. And the point I want to make is that the only way we can detect it early in our current setting is to reinforce our current TB control program, including improving the way in which we collect our sputum and other diagnostic samples, and trying to improve that. And you've heard a lot about this already, so I will not bore you with those details. We need to have rapid culture and drug sensitivity testing techniques, and you've heard a lot about that. MODS appears to be an attractive possibility, but it needs to be tested in other settings to see how feasible it is given our current infrastructure challenges. And these are some of the new diagnostic tests which I think the next speaker is going to cover. And MODS, again, as I said, is attractive. I won't go through the details in the interest of time and because I believe it will be covered later, but certainly it is very attractive for me as a clinician to know that we could get our culture and sensitivity results within days rather than months. But I think we hope but do not have such a test currently available. So in conclusion, I think that we're not going to see new diagnostic tests or rapid culture and sensitivity testing for some time, and certainly I'm not sure that these are going to be made available at the point of contact given the huge challenges. They're probably going to be too expensive. And therefore, again, I must conclude by saying that we have to strengthen our TB control programs with early detection of failure to make sure we have widespread implementation of DOTS. We must have screening and contact tracing, and we must improve communication with labs, all of which can be done with very little cost. And again, like Keith and Deda showed you, I think we need to understand the reality. And this is how the majority of our patients who are afflicted with TB and HIV live. This is the kind of overcrowding we still see. And in fact, this is a picture taken of the rural area around the Tugela Ferry area where many of our patients with HDR-TB come from. And you can understand from this the huge challenges we face. And therefore, as a clinician, I think we have no clues on how to diagnose HDR-TB when the patient first presents. We need, if we reinforce our TB control program, I believe we will be able to identify these patients much sooner than we had done in the past. I believe that HDR-TB existed before it was exposed in the Tugela Ferry study, but it was the Global Fund program where we integrated TB and HIV that led us to identify it, because what we did is we did routine culture on all these patients even when they were smear positive. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Lalu, for highlighting some fairly serious problems. I think we have a lot of thinking to do to go around some of these problems. We have about a minute or two for points of clarifications. If there's anybody with any issue to raise before we move on to the next speaker. Yes. I thought you were preparing yourself to do that.
And you prompted me to do. Thank you. I appreciate your presentation, and I by and large agree with your conclusions. However, I would challenge the premise that these tests are going to take a long time to come. I think part of what needs to happen is the demand that we accelerate the evaluation of these very promising tests. Looking forward to the next presentation, because I think you're going to see that there are many in the horizon that are just on the verge of being field evaluated. We live in a world where there's a global fund and where, by virtue of now paying for antiretrovirals, we are implementing new lab technology. I've seen places in the world where I never dreamt would have access to basic lab capacity doing viral load and CD4 counting. And in those settings, I would challenge how could you justify leaving the microbacteriology field behind, given that this is the most common opportunistic disease? So it's mostly a comment rather than a question. I very much appreciate and applaud the work you've done into Galaferi, and in many ways have raised the awareness of the rest of the world by virtue of your work. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to share your optimism, but I think if you're having difficulty implementing simple guidelines for smear negative TB, then implementing new technology is going to be a problem. More so, I believe that if we had implemented current technology effectively, we may have not found ourselves in such a mess. But I think we are here because we are optimistic.
Turn back to my co-chair to introduce the next speaker.
Thank you. It is then my pleasure to introduce... Is this working? I think it's dead. To introduce Dr. Rick O'Brien, currently from FIND, which is the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics. And Rick, we are all waiting with bated breath to hear which new test you are going to give us.
Thanks very much, Nalda. And I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers or coordinators of the symposium for inviting me to be the very last speaker of the very last symposium at the very end of a very long series of meetings that began for me last Monday. So I'm grateful that I'm still standing.
I think I'm personally going to ask, every year I pull the last session on the last day to chair. So welcome, Rick.
For those of you who may have attended the symposium yesterday afternoon in this auditorium, you heard me announce that John Ritterhoff and I were competing to see who would give the same presentation the greatest number of times at this meeting. And I was hoping to be able to announce today that with this talk, I will have won. But I was devastated just a couple hours ago to run into Frank Kobelins from KNZV, who told me that with a presentation he'll give tomorrow, yet at another side meeting, he will have caught up and we'll both be tied for five each. So again, if you've heard this before, I beg your indulgence. I will end on, I think, a more positive, upbeat conclusion. The other thing to say is that because a number of things that are in the pipeline that I'll mention have been covered, I won't have to go into too much detail because it would be repetitive. And so I will probably finish before my allotted time, and we'll have more time for discussion. So the title of my talk was, What is in the Pipeline for New MDR XDR diagnostics, so I'm not going to focus on diagnostic tests like microscopy and culture, but again, more on the identification of drug resistance. And it's important to note that when we're considering new technologies, we need to ask what level of the health system will they be used and where will they be have the greatest impact. And much of what is in the pipeline that has great promise is actually at the central level where there are good facilities for testing and introduction of new, more complex technologies, but there the issue of specimen collection, transport, and turnaround time for reporting becomes important. At the peripheral setting, we're actually, and on my last slide I'll describe the technique that we think has promise for decentralization of rapid screening for MDR-TB. Unfortunately, at the level where a new test could have the greatest impact, a point-of-care test that would be a lateral flow assay or a dipstick, I think it's quite unlikely we'll have a test specifically for MDR that could operate like this and have a significant impact at the in the periphery anytime in the near future. Just to show you what's in FIND's pipeline, which is not the total, the tests we have for use at the more central level, particularly the Hine molecular assay, I'll describe in some detail. At the microscopy level, the Cepheid assay. In terms of newer rapid DST methods, a number of these have already been mentioned, the commercial liquid systems, other culture methods such as direct testing on solid media with a colorimetric readout like the GREAS method actually provides for very reliable results on smear-positive specimens in 2 weeks or so. MODS has been mentioned by several speakers. Direct midget drug susceptibility testing is quite feasible and possible and speeds up detection time of drug resistance, but has not been widely evaluated. These kind of non-commercial tests are less expensive, but need culture-capable labs, again, a big challenge. And finally, a phage assay with results in 2 days and molecular methods, both manual methods and automated methods coming on. The automated liquid systems are faster, more sensitive, but have their drawbacks as well in terms of greater technical requirements and expense and more complexity. We've introduced recently a new rapid species identification method that's paired with liquid systems that cuts down the time to determine whether a positive culture is MTB from days or weeks using standard biochemical methods to just minutes with a very simple-to-use technology that costs less than $1 a test. I think Madhu may have mentioned that our midget demonstration projects, large-scale demonstration projects of liquid culture and DST, were used to help convince WHO that these systems are feasible for implementation in low-resource settings. The guidance that was issued by WHO last month is actually very cautionary and urging countries and programs not to rush into this, but in a very careful, thoughtful way, detailing a number of concerns and issues that should be addressed. FIND and BD announced last week a new pricing structure that would provide for culture and DST that is fairly rapid in terms of having results in 21 to 28 days with a big improvement over solid culture methods for a cost to most low-income countries of less than $10 for culture and drug susceptibility testing, diclofenac and rifampin. MODS has been mentioned, and one of the parts of David Moore's paper was to indicate that direct drug susceptibility testing, diclofenac and rifampin using MODS with results in only a week or so may be possible with good sensitivity and specificity for rifampin and somewhat less for diclofenac, but we really need further validation and evaluation of this that, again, is a fairly inexpensive and promising technique. The system is basically the same as midget. It uses the same media and has a different readout. The Phage assay that we've been working with that was developed largely here in South Africa is a rapid and fairly reliable method for determining rifampin resistance in just 2 days. It has two drawbacks, though. One, it's rather labor-intensive, a large number of steps that have to be carried out in a culture-capable laboratory by a trained technician. And for specimens that are less intensely smear-positive, like 1+ positive specimens, has a rather high rate of indeterminate results, 15% to 20%, and these issues have to be addressed. I really think the future for rapid diagnosis of drug resistance is in molecular testing, and there are two Lyme probe assays on the market, the inolipistrip from Inogenetics and the Hein MTBDR plus assay that we've been working with that I think have the potential to really change things and change things quite quickly. The Hein assay is a standard PCR assay with three steps, DNA extraction, amplification, and then reverse hybridization with a readout on a cellulose strip that's impregnated with oligonucleotides and a visual readout. In preparation for a large-scale demonstration project that is now underway in South Africa, intending to apply this test to 20,000 patients over the next year at risk of MDR-TB, and this is actually being done in two provinces and is beginning in KZN and Kimberley in the very near future. And so patients will have access to this quite soon. In preparation for the projects, we needed to do additional validation work or evaluation work on the assay that had been changed a bit to improve its sensitivity and include another probe for isoniazid resistance. And so this assay was performed directly on smear-positive sputum specimens, 536, collected over about a one-month period from patients in the Western Cape and sent to the laboratory here in Cape Town. The specimens were cultured on midget and drug susceptibility testing on solid media using the proportional method. And we also looked at 100 smear-negative specimens, and the primary outcome being performance test accuracy for isoniazid resistance or rifampin resistance, MDR-TB on smear-positive specimens compared to conventional results, and the secondary outcomes of turnaround time and performance on smear-negative specimens. And we were rather astounded with the results. 97% of the specimens had interpretable results saying yes, tuberculosis, isoniazid resistance, yes, no, rifampin resistance, yes, no. 55 midget cultures were contaminated, so we never had any results. The assay performed well on those specimens that were subsequently contaminated on culture. There were 86 MDR isolates by conventional testing, so a bit under 20%. Sensitivity, specificity, and predictive values were outstanding, missing only a single multi-drug resistant, so it picked up 85 of 86 MDRs correctly, and no false positives, and had accurate results for 14 of the 15 smear-negative specimens that turned out to be culture positive. And turnaround time, the assay can be done in 1 day, but with batching or depending upon where you start on a given day, it may take 2 days. But what we're seeing now in the demonstration projects underway in Western Cape and Gauteng is that the turnaround time from specimen collection to reporting results to the clinician is under 7 days. So our conclusion is that the performance of this assay is actually superior to conventional culture and DST, importantly in terms of speed, accuracy, high level of interpretable results, and the potential for high throughput. A single technician can do 200 to 300 tests per day, the limitation being in the initial upfront sputum processing. Cost of testing, actually the cost of consumables is based on even the favorable prices we have with BD, is 50% that for the conventional culture and DST. This assay has the potential to substantially reduce the need, if we see these performance characteristics elsewhere, reduce the need for culture and DST when screening for MDR-TB. We believe it is much easier to establish this capability in a lab that's never done molecular testing before than it is to build a new culture-capable laboratory and new sputum processing methods may likely both increase sensitivity in making it close to culture and facilitate transport. We know that the assay works quite well on processed specimens inoculated on filter paper, dried, and mailed in. So, again, the potential for facilitated transport, cutting down also, importantly, on any biohazard because the specimens are inactivated. Just mention the people involved with the work here, Marinus Bernard, a molecular biologist at the lab in Cape Town, Heidi Albert, who is with FIND overseeing these projects, Garrett Kutzia from the NHLS TB lab, and Marlene Bozeman, head of the laboratory here. And then to conclude with the last slide, that we hope has similar performance characteristics but can be decentralized because the Hine assay will not be. This is a sepia test that was also mentioned earlier. One-step processing, rather simple sputum processing, putting the processed sputum into a cartridge, and within 90 minutes having a read for tuberculosis, yes, no, rifampin resistance, yes, no, at a level that only requires electricity and essentially no technician training. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Rick. Thought-provoking and exciting. Any questions for Rick specifically before we call
for Rick, yeah.
The panel?
Yes. Ruben Grant for WHO HIV/AIDS, and my goal is to be one of the last questions of the last session. So, Rick, thanks for a great talk. And it's a bit of a follow-on to Dr. Castro's question. I was wondering if you could – I was really encouraged by your last few slides there. I was wondering if you could talk about the cost in relation to, let's say, viral loads or CD4 counts. Which are, you know, commonly being offered now in many places. Thank you.
Unfortunately not, because I had known nothing about the cost of viral load testing or CD4 testing, and maybe someone here could comment on those costs. We've done some very detailed costing analyses for the MIDGET projects, and the cost of solid or liquid culture and DST for isoniazid and rifampin is around $20 when you consider the complete laboratory costs. Considering that this assay, just for the consumables, the test kits and TAC polymerase, as well as the equipment required, is less than that for liquid culture and DST, and the high throughput, so the human costs per test performed are substantially less. I expect when we do the costing from the demonstration projects, we'll see this coming out to maybe under $10 per test done, considering the total cost, not just the cost of the tests themselves. I don't know if there's anyone here who can comment on cost of viral loads or CD4s.
Okay. Then may I ask a question, Rick? Something that worried me, maybe I had your figures wrong. If there were 537 consecutive positive smears and 55 were contaminated, you were left with less than 500, of which 55 were MDR.
No, 86 were MDR. 86 of the roughly 500 specimens were turned out to be MDR.
That is scary.
Yes. We know nothing about the patients. This was a laboratory validation, so no patient information was collected, but these were from specimens from patients in the Western Cape whose specimens were submitted for culture and DST, presumably because of an increased risk of MDR. And yes, I agree with you.
I won't sleep tonight. Okay. Can we call everyone who presented in the session to come forward, please? And then we'll open for discussion. We've made up lots of time. So we will allow a few questions. Thank you. Now I have to put on my glasses again so that I can see. Any questions? Somebody who wants to? Yes, please.
It's more a comment than a question. I'd like to thank all the presenters for some fantastic deliveries and very interesting information. I think this conference has been very heartening. to hear of the new diagnostics that are coming through, and to hear also of the recognition of the laboratory capacity strengthening and the scale of it that's required to support this. And we look forward to when the evaluations of these new tests are completed and they can be made accessible. Like Rick, I have tremendous faith in the genetic, the molecular methods for delivering an equitable, accessible service for drug resistance testing. But what's been particularly heartening, I think, is that there's a recognition of the need to improve existing tools and to integrate this with the new tools that are coming through. And there's a lot of focus on LED microscopes for fluorescence microscopy that could improve the sensitivity of smear microscopy. And one of our speakers also mentioned the need to improve specimen collection. And I think this is key, that we need to, for detecting tuberculosis cases earlier using existing tools, we need to put together a package that can create these optimized smear microscopy services. This includes the better collection of specimen. It includes trying to get same-day diagnosis on smear diagnostic services so we don't lose patients to dropout. It's including LED fluorescence to increase sensitivity and speed up the passage of patients' specimens through the laboratory. And I think another potential is bleach digestion of sputum and increasing diagnosis that way. An important study that was conducted in Matari, funded by MSF and conducted by Epicentre and Liverpool School, showed that even in a high HIV setting, there could be a 15% increase in case detection from a standardised overnight bleach sedimentation method. So I think we need to think kind of creatively about how we mix different technologies together to maximise the impact of new diagnostics.
Would you like to comment on that, Rick?
No, I don't think it was a question. I fully agree.
Yeah. Okay, so that was just agree. Thank you.
Hi, Russell Dackham, Liverpool Associates in Tropical Health. Kind of a bit of a follow-on question for Andy. So it's on, you know, the theme that's gone throughout this conference is a need to strengthen the laboratory systems. I think most people are agreed on that point. But bearing in mind the kind of human resource crisis in a lot of countries, which leaves them kind of devoid of the degree of lab expertise that's required to set up these central reference lab facilities and other types of lab systems. And this may not be the right question for the panel, but it's the last session of the day, so I feel I've got to ask it, so it may just end up being a comment. Where is all this international TA going to come from? Do we have the capacity internationally to deliver this degree of sustained TA to the countries that most need it?
Was that a comment or a specific question for a specific person?
Well, I see a few people in the audience, and I mean Rick as well, who may wish to answer that. If not, I'll leave it as a comment.
Does anyone from the panel would like? Okay, Berenice, respond.
Thank you. As a laboratory, and I think we do have a number of international consultants. We have the Association of Public Health Laboratories that have been very helpful in a number of countries, the American Society for Microbiology, which is a large organization that has 42,000 members. Obviously, all of them are not mycobacteriologists or clinical microbiologists, but a number of them, probably a good 30% or more of them, are microbiologists, and certainly other organizations, universities. So we do have a lot of capacity for technical assistance, and I think we're still working on, a lot of the organizations are still working on getting that capacity out. So there are a number of organizations that can assist with that.
Okay,
Rick. Just to add to that, and maybe after what I say, John, you can supplement. The newly named Global Laboratory Initiative under John Ritterhoff's leadership has obviously recognized this as a huge issue and has a couple of things in its business plan to address it, including better coordination of technical assistance and procedures to ensure that the consultants actually provide consistent advice. One of our MIDGET projects is in a large HIV/AIDS care program in Western Kenya that had three different laboratorians visit over the course of 4 months to the new TB lab, and each gave a slightly different recommendation. As you can imagine, it's quite confusing to newly trained laboratorians who are just starting to do culture. Another proposal to train up to 100 persons from countries who come in as a middle-level managers in the complete gamut of what it takes to develop, establish, and run laboratories. And John?
If I could just add a couple things to that. One thing, I think, you know, we talk about culture, but sometimes we say we also need a cultural change. We need to start valuing lab consultation. There's been a handful, whereas you could say there's many people who have been trained and spent time in countries full-time as program consultants. So we need to sort of change, I think, our value system if we see and look and make sure the resources are there. I think Rick discussed we need to start providing more consistent training. The country issues, and I think that's where it really has to be solved in the countries, are rather complex. But one of those, for at least microscopy, is a discussion. There's sometimes obviously a lot of challenges to this, that we need a new cadre of microscopists. Now, the issue that's been discussed and people have moved forward for ZN, could we do the same for fluorescent microscopy? If we don't have folks at the health center level, can we train? I think there's a lot of examples that you could. And that also takes a shift, so the laboratory technology community is not too protectionist. They actually see this as an opportunity that they have a supervisory and leadership role, and it's not just merely that they have to perform every test. This is something that's also occurred in the whole HIV community, I think, of moving to other allied personnel being allowed to do the test. So these are difficult. We don't want to underestimate the challenge, but certainly this is an area in microscopy where you can decentralize it more, but you do have to have the support mechanisms. Maybe the trained lab tech can be the supporting supervisor, not necessarily the person doing the test.
May I ask something, John? While you move this forward, will you also please speak to the electricity supply companies in Africa? We all have power sharing. Maybe you can get them up to speed.
So we don't have the fluorescent microscope that works with a mirror. That is a point. We don't. There's still issues to be done, but maybe there have been sort of battery powered. Maybe anybody else can for bright field. I haven't even thought about, say, fluorescent on that. I don't know if others can add on that.
Thank you, Janina. We will come to you, I promise. But I think you want to answer specifically to that, Skirta.
No, I just want to add to that. One of the biggest issues with training and capacity on the laboratory side is training is one thing, but retaining the staff is another. And one of the biggest problems we face in the lab in Cape Town is adequate staff. And it's a very complex issue, as you said. But I think remuneration and career progression is one of the key aspects. Now, that, again, is a complex issue of how you address that. And it's got to be done from within countries. But I think you have to start talking about that because once you train these staff, to actually retain them with the salary scales that they currently get, I don't think there's much hope of that happening.
Thank you. Janina?
Hi, I'm Janina Morrison. I'm from University of Stellenbosch and also University of California in San Francisco. I have a question about the Tugela Ferry experience, which I don't think you touched on. I was just wondering, in terms of infection control, what the response was. You were talking about using mechanisms that you already have and what kind of changes in policy you've seen. You showed this picture of the nurse who actually died from XDR, and what kinds of new policies do you have to keep patients within the hospital from getting infected and the staff?
Yes, I think that's an important question. The patient I showed you was not the patient from Tugela Ferry, but there were a number of presentations on new approaches to infection control, and surprisingly it was all the simple measures that seemed to work best. For example, just keeping windows open and having good ventilation was far superior than having extractor fans. But those measures are in place at the Church of Scotland Hospital, and they seem to be producing very promising results at low cost. But there were a number of presentations during this conference on that issue, which is very encouraging, because it seems like the simple things do work very well, like exposure to sunlight and using our good climate for good ventilation rather than sealing off our wards.
Thank you.
Okay.
I wanted to come back to the previously discussed topic. One observation that I made is I recently forced myself to sit through some of the pandemic influenza planning that's taking place at CEC and many other parts of the world. In that venue, I have listened to discussions, not unlike this one, where one of the goals is to improve the capacity to do surveillance of influenza strains, often on PCR-based methods, grappling with the same issues. We know that there's a polio eradication program that now exists in the world and has the capacity to transport specimens from any child anywhere in the world with acute flaccid paralysis to determine if they have polio or not. And what we need to start doing is start dealing with these cross-cutting systems-wide issues so that we don't try to monolithically solve it by ourselves. So yes, there's our mycobacteriology lab needs, but everyone else is faced with those needs. And the more we can do to build on each other's approaches, we can then come up with a fix that will build public health lab capacity in all these countries, because that's what's been crying for a need for too long. So I think I've seen opportunities that we haven't really harnessed. And I know that John, when they presented to the coordinating board, the Stop TB Partners at coordinating board, the plan, one of the recommendations made was start looking at how you can work to improve lab, not just microbacteriology lab. So it's the comment I wanted to add, because I've heard these discussions and laments from others who are more than happy to work with us if we bring ourselves to them.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Madhu.
This is partly related to the lab quality issue, but I wanted to ask Rick this. I see the excitement over molecular assay in terms of sensitivity and specificity and how much promise they hold. But with the earlier experience with Matt, and John is here, where there's a reproducibility issue across labs, a whole wave of studies published in the 90s and the 80s said that if the same specimen is done in 10 different labs, the NAT results are highly non-reproducible. And given that these are molecular assays too, has anybody tried doing the same Hein assay on the same specimen in 10 different labs to see how much of variation the tests are likely to throw up, and what steps would need to be put in place to ensure reproducibility, not just accuracy?
The short answer is no. But we do need to validate this assay in other settings and other laboratories to see what kind of results we get. But that reproducibility issue I don't think is an important one, because these are validated against the results of conventional culture and DST. So if it works as well in another setting with different specimens, I don't think that's really an issue. I don't know if you still agree with me, but...
No, I just thought that one of the big issues with NAT in the earlier days of NAT, the older NAT, was this whole issue of the same specimen not giving consistent results across NAT. I mean, they set up an entire surveillance quality system for NAT in the U.S., and John was involved with that.
Word, so he can tell us.
We set up the direct amplification on specimens. We sent out samples, and we were able to publish, at least in the first few shipments, there was lots of false positives. You'd send out a Mycobacterium Gordoni and so on. I do think this is a lesson. There's maybe a couple points. This is sort of a systems piece. Do we have these kind of EQA programs for that? The other one, Ken's issue of integration, there's two things. You still need the mycobacteriology laboratory suite for, the specimen processing, but in some cases you can have the shared, say, PCR suites, but that in itself is a discipline that you will have to look at right now until it can be completely compartmentalized like the Cepheid, as I think I understand it. There still will be technique issues. You will have to be very careful across contamination. And this would be good. We need these global programs, whether it's for culture or amplification. And even preferably, instead of being a program, why don't we get the NEQUAS or some of these other programs to make, you know, do they have that available, and that people can enroll, just from a business marketing model. But you do need EQA when possible. So I think, well, that's...
Yes. I'd like to make a comment in relationship to what Dr. Castro said on the human resources and in relationship to what John just said and several others. In terms of human resources, we do need to look at the integration, but one of the key points to integrating an entire laboratory system for public health service or for clinical care service like we're dealing with now is infrastructure. Most of our laboratory technologists, technicians are doing integrated work anyway. The unfortunate event is they do not have a laboratory that will support, the infrastructure will not support or has to be built up in order to support sophisticated chemistry testing systems, which in some cases we're putting in, but they need to have electrical power backup. Many countries don't have that. And thus, testing for things like that, which are really high volume, can be put through very fast, and then we can allow more time for more specialized testing systems like TB, but we really do need to develop the infrastructure. We also need to develop that so that we can look at things like reproducibility studies. These are things that do take a number of human resource issues. And finally, I think we do also need to be able to look at training laboratory technologists well before they come out to school and before they get into the laboratory with bad habits, that we have to continue to try to revamp them once they've gotten into the laboratory. So I think those are some issues, you know, that can be looked at.
Thank you. Any other comments? Anyone from the panel? A final comment? Okay, then it is my pleasure to thank you all for sitting through the very last session on the very last day. But I think this was a fabulous session, and I certainly am optimistic that we will soon have something new and brilliant out there. And thank you to all the speakers and to the wonderful audience and for participating.